You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
In these weeks leading up to Good Friday and Easter, we are looking at a collection of stories and teachings in the Gospel of Mark. And this middle section, chapters 8 through 10, where we've been, is all about discipleship to Jesus, what it means to follow him. The disciples are like literally following him. They're on a journey to Jerusalem, but as they go on the way, Jesus stops and teaches them and us what it means to follow him. The pattern that we've seen, and we're going to see it again today, goes like this. Jesus explains what his mission is. He tells them what's going to happen when they get to Jerusalem. And then the disciples totally don't get it. Like the first time he told them, Peter pulled him aside and rebuked him. Peter was like, hey, I heard what you said. I think you're wrong. And Jesus was like, well, I'm Jesus. So I think you're wrong. I think your mind is on the things of earth and not on the things of heaven. And that pattern goes over and over. Every time Jesus tells them what's going to happen and they don't get it, then Jesus pulls them together and gives further teaching to clarify the mission and explain even further what it means to follow him, not just to Jerusalem, but for us to follow him every day of our lives, wherever we are. The way Mark tells this story, he keeps coming back to the confusion and the blind spots that the disciples have, as if to say, he understands us. As if to say, he knows this is what our lives are like too. We hear the truth over and over, and then we do things, sometimes immediately, that are contrary to the truth we just heard. We keep coming back to the same struggles and good intentions and blind spots. Why is that? I assume you have that experience, otherwise I'm going to feel very alone up here. But why is that? What keeps us from seeing Jesus clearly? We often think that the solution is knowing more. Like if I could just get in a good Bible study, then I'll see. Or doing more. Like if I could do more for the church or for God, then I would see things better. Now listen, knowing the truth and doing the truth are like vital to our discipleship. I am not in any way minimizing those things. I'm just saying that the cause of our blindness is deeper than those things. Jesus cuts to the heart of the matter with one question. You see it in verse 36, right in the middle of the passage. The question is, what do you want me to do for you? It's a pretty powerful question because it pushes past what we know and what we can do. And it deals with us at the level of our desire, what we want, what we love. And so the reason that we don't see Jesus clearly has to do with what we want. 2 summers ago, I took a sabbatical, 3 months to rest and reflect on life and ministry, and I had a coach. We would have these weekly phone calls, and in one of the first phone calls, he asked me this question. He said, Will, what do you want? And I was completely frozen. I was like, I don't know. What do you mean? I want tacos? I don't know. What are you talking about? He asked me to make a list of the things that I want. And for 3 months, every time I sat down to work on that list, it was just like nothing. I couldn't write anything down. And the reason was is because I was really wrestling with all the motives and all the stuff. I wanted to want the right things for the right reasons. And I couldn't sort it out in my soul. When Jesus asks the question, what do you want me to do for you? He's helping us sort it out. On one hand, he's bringing really tremendous clarity to our lives. But also, he's giving us a clue to how the whole thing works. You see, because we usually think about discipleship in terms of what we can do for Jesus. But he's reframing the conversation to be about what he can do for us. That's the twist at the end of the passage. I just gave it to you. We'll get there, but I want to like look at what leads up to it. And so let's start by thinking about and looking at what did the disciples want. Verse 32. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus is walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. There'll be a great injustice. And then they will deliver him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. There will be humiliation and death. And after 3 days, he will rise." Okay, here's how you have to understand what Jesus is doing here. He's telling them again, this is the third time, what's going to happen. But the problem is the disciples don't get it. And the reason is because of what they want. What do they want? Like, to put it plainly, they want what they want. What I mean by that is they want what they have been culturally conditioned to want. They want basically the same thing that everyone around them wants. They might have slapped a Jesus sticker on it, but it's the same stuff. Comfort, control, power, approval. It's just in a different field. That's not all Jesus at all what Jesus is talking about. He's saying we're going to suffer and die, but they can't see it because they can't see past what they want. I remember a long time ago when my boys were little, I needed to go to Target to get a birthday present for Debbie. That's how we roll. So I told the boys, "Listen, we got to go to Target to get a present for Mom." And they got excited because they had only gone to Target for one thing before. Like, we used to get them toys at Target. And so when they heard the word Target, they immediately thought about the toy aisle and the things they wanted. That's what Target meant to them. Now, I could see this happening, and so I gathered them in. I was like, "Hey, listen. We're not going to Target to get toys. We're going to Target to get a birthday gift for Mom." I made him look at me in the eyes, you know, because a boy, he's not listening unless he's looking at you. Turns out, even if they're listening, they don't necessarily understand what you're saying. And so I was like, "Look, we're not thinking at all about what we want or what we're going to get for ourselves. That's not the purpose of the trip. The purpose of the trip is to think about what we can get for Mom." When we parked the car, before we got out of the car, we'd had a review session. I was like, "Listen, guys, look at me. We're going to go in that store. It's called Target. I know you know that. And we're not even going to the toy aisle. We're not going to go anywhere near that part of the store because Mom doesn't want anything over there. We're going to go to another part of the store. We're here to get something for Mom. So don't ask me for anything while we're in there. You follow along and help me pick out something for Mom." I honestly don't know how I could be any clearer. I mean, visuals maybe, I don't know. But within minutes of being in the store, they both had something in their hands saying, "Dad, can I have this?" How could that even possibly happen? I'll tell you how it could happen. They want what they want. I said, like, the words that I said are, "We're going to Target to get something for Mom." But they didn't hear anything past Target. And Target could only mean one thing for them: toys. They simply did not have a category for going to Target for any reason other than getting something for themselves. We have something like that here with the disciples. Jesus said, "We're going to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer and die." But the disciples didn't hear anything past, "We're going to Jerusalem." And for them, Jerusalem could only mean one thing. You see, they had been taught and trained from an early age that the Messiah would come to set his people free, to deliver them like Moses delivered God's people out of Egypt. The Messiah would go to Jerusalem, conquer their enemies. He would sit on the throne of David and rule and bring Israel back to her glory. The disciples did not have a category for a suffering Messiah. They want what they want. And it's absolutely blinding them to the real Jesus. I think we should ask ourselves, How have we been trained? What has our culture conditioned us to want? And how is that blinding us to the real Jesus? We all tend to relate to God in ways that kind of just affirm our way of seeing the world. And you see that here with James and John. Look at verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, otherwise known as the sons of thunder, they came up to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." That's a pretty bold move, isn't it? Jesus, we're going to ask you a question. Before we do, I need you to say yes. This is like how junior high boys, maybe some adult boys among us, ask out girls. It's like, I'm going to ask that girl out, but I need to know through the back channels first that she's going to say yes before I ask. I don't want to run the risk. I mean, they're walking up to Jesus and saying, "Hey, here's a blank check. Could you, if you just sign down on the bottom, that would be great." It's a ridiculous question. It's absurd. But that's where their wants have gotten them. The absurd part about it is that they presume to know what's best for them. And I'm telling you, it is God's grace that he does not give us everything we ask for. If I gave my kids everything they asked for, I would have ruined them, like worse than I already did. It's God's grace. Jesus does not dismiss them, though. He says, "Well, what do you want me to do for you?" There's the question. It seems innocent enough in context, but we know there's purpose behind this question. He's not just playing along. He's probing. In verse 37, they said to him, "Here's what we want. Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." You see, they had a vision for what the kingdom of God was going to be like and what their role would be in it. They're basically coming to Jesus and saying, "Hey, just try this on for size. Can you imagine how cool it would be? You on the throne and at your right and left, the sons of thunder? I mean, that's pretty awesome." The problem is not their ambition or their desire to be great. That's not the problem. The problem is that their vision, their definition of greatness, is shaped more by the values of their culture than it is the teachings of Jesus. The next few verses illustrate just how far off course the wrong vision can take us. Look at verse 38. Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" Now, these are rich Old Testament symbols. The cup is a symbol of God's judgment and wrath against sin. And baptism here is a symbol of like Jesus's solidarity with sinners, his willingness to bear the judgment of their sin. And so this is a rhetorical question. They are not able. To drink the cup that Jesus drinks and to be baptized with the baptism he's going to undergo. But, verse 39, they say, "We are able." Again, they don't know what they're asking. In their minds, you know, there were like commonly esteemed qualifications for sitting at the right hand and the left hand of Jesus in the kingdom, in the earthly kingdom. And they're basically saying, "We're qualified. We've got the devotion, we've got the skills, we've got the connections. We're the sons of thunder." And Jesus is just saying that those aren't the qualifications. You've got it all wrong. The qualifications are your willingness to suffer for my sake. They're not going to suffer in the same way that Jesus suffered, but they are going to suffer because sharing in the sufferings of Christ is just part of what it means for all of us to follow him. I love this note at the very beginning of the passage that kind of stuck with me the whole way through, that Jesus was walking ahead of them. They're going to Jerusalem, where he's going to suffer and die. There'll be persecution and hardship, and he's walking ahead of them. He's going first into the suffering and persecution. In spite of all of their pride and naivety and selfish ambition, he doesn't leave them. He leads them. Listen, we're all on the way with Jesus. We're all in process. We have our own misguided visions and confusion and blind spots, but he doesn't leave us. I've just overwhelmed this week with the patience of Jesus in this text. He leads us. But listen, that means he leads us. We don't get to just imagine the life that we want and say, okay, lead us there. That's not how it works. The problem with the disciples is that they want what they want. They want to be great, but they have the wrong understanding of greatness. What they should want is to be great as Jesus defines it. And so let's talk for a minute how Jesus defines greatness. Verse 42. Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all." All right, remember, this isn't the first time that Jesus is taught on what it means to be great. Now, we saw this in chapter 9. A few weeks ago, I preached a sermon on true greatness. It was a pretty good sermon. You can go back and check it out. I'm not going to say a lot about that today for that reason. But the main feature in these verses is the contrast between how power and authority is used in this world and how power and authority is exercised in the kingdom of God. Jesus says, look, the people who are considered rulers in this world, those who the world deems great, they use their position and their power and their authority to, he says, lord it over them, to exercise authority over them. It's the same word, and it just means to bring someone under your power, to control them. And we've all experienced this. Power and authority in this world are often used for selfish gain. And he's saying that it's not that way among you. In other words, that is not how the kingdom of God operates. And if you operate contrary, if you operate like that, you stand outside the norm of God's kingdom. The way the kingdom of God operates is that people use their power and authority and position to serve and bless others. Greatness in the kingdom of God is not measured by what people do for you. It's measured by what you do for them. The word servant was commonly used for like a waiter or waitress. It could mean a household servant. The word slave here refers to a bond servant, which is much different than the way we would think about modern slavery or Western slavery. A bond servant could sell himself into slavery, into the service of a master for a limited amount of time. The main reason they would do that is to improve their economic condition. The point Jesus is making is that a slave is even lower than a servant. A slave was the least and the last. And so when he says, whoever would be first among you must be a slave, that sounds ridiculous to them. That is like the camel through the eye of the needle thing that we talked about last week. Like, what are you even talking about? That doesn't make any sense. But that's how it is in the kingdom of God. Here's why Jesus uses the image of the servant and the slave. Because the servant and the slave's activities are directed toward the interests of others, not to their own interests. Among God's people, greatness is measured by how we use our power and authority and how our activities are directed toward the interests of the others. That is what we should want. We should want to give ourselves away for the good of others, our money, our time, our strength. I should want to serve more than I want to be served. I should want to ask questions more than I want to talk about myself. I should want to give to the poor more than I want the next thing that has caught my eye. I should want to draw near to God in my suffering instead of thinking he has abandoned me. There's a lot of stuff that I should want, but should never change anybody. It just puts us under the pile. I have a friend here that used to say, don't should on me. All right, so I'm not here to should on you. Because should won't change us. If all that Jesus was doing was showing them what they should do, that's cruel. The only way that we will change is if we have new wants. In other words, we need to be transformed, not at the level of our knowing and doing, but at the level of our desire, our tastes. How do we get that? I mean, that's a hard question. How do you change what you want when you just want what you want? I think Jesus tells us how. Verse 45. He's told them, you should be a servant. You should be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Okay. There's a lot of like power and purpose packed in that little word for. It doesn't just say the reason you should be a servant is because Jesus has set an example as a servant. That is true. But there's more in this verse. It's saying the only way you'll ever want to serve like this or be able to serve like this is because Jesus serves you. Here's the twist. Discipleship is not about serving Jesus. It's about Jesus serving us. That's what will change our hearts, give us new desires, and enable us to be truly great. And so let's consider from this verse how Jesus serves us. The Son of Man came. He came. Like, that's incredible. When you want to serve somebody, you go to them, don't you? Jesus didn't meet us halfway, as it were. He came all the way to us. Can you even fathom the distance of that? He came from the throne room of heaven to a manger in Galilee. He came from boundless energy and strength to take on the limitations of a human body. He who was and is and always will be took on the constraints of time. He who had perfect fellowship with the Father and the Spirit came down low to dine with sinners and tax collectors. The high and exalted one came down to us. He came not to be served, but to serve. So let's just say Jesus did come down to fulfill the disciples' expectations, that he sat on the throne of David, conquered their enemies such that they served him and ruled Israel. Let's just say that happened. That would still be a massive demotion from his place as King of Heaven. He had the right to do that, but he didn't. Paul says he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. He came not to be served, but to serve. And I just think the clearest picture of that I know of is in John 13. You know the scene? Jesus has taken the disciples to an upper room for the Last Supper. That's where this happens. And John tells us on the way, the disciples were arguing about who was the greatest. Again, different scenario, same argument. And so when they got there, it would be normal to like wash your feet, like we wash our hands for dinner, just like normal stuff. But washing feet was a dirty job, and so that was reserved for like the lowest of the servants, for the slaves. And there weren't any slaves there. It was just them and Jesus. And so they're arguing about who's the greatest. They're not about to like then wash each other's feet and take that low position, right? And so they don't. They just skip it. And so in the middle of supper, they're all eating with their dirty feet. Jesus gets up from the table. He takes off his outer garment and he wraps it around his waist like a servant would. And then he gets some water in a bowl like a servant would, and he begins to wash their feet like a slave would. The one who is greatest among them becomes a slave to all of them. And Peter's not having it. Like, he knows how backwards this is. Gets around to him and he's like, no, I see what you're doing here. No, you do not wash my feet. And Jesus is like, well, yes, I do. If I don't, then you have no share with me. And to have a share with Jesus is kind of shorthand for like belonging to him and to his kingdom. And so all of a sudden, we're not just talking about dinner etiquette anymore. We're talking about something much deeper. Jesus sees the dirt in our hearts, our lust and pride, greed and selfish ambition. He sees all of it, and he has compassion because he knows we can't clean ourselves up. And so he's saying to Peter and to us, unless you let me wash you, you can never be clean. Unless I die for you, you won't be able to live with me. If Peter wants to be clean deep down, he has to let Jesus serve him. And Peter is just too humble for that to happen. Sometimes humility looks like pride. Discipleship is not about serving Jesus. It's about Jesus serving us, and then how that enables us to serve others. Right after Jesus washes their feet, he gives them a command to now do the same thing to one another, to love one another as he has loved them, to serve others as he has served them. So that's part of the deal. He's just saying, unless you let me serve you, you won't want to do that, know how to do that, or have the capacity for that. Discipleship begins with Jesus serving us, and that is the way that we become the kind of people who want and can serve others. He came not to serve, be served, but to serve, and lastly, to give his life as a ransom for many. This is an important part of the passage. This is the key, maybe, to the book of Mark. The death of Jesus was not symbolic. It was not like a gesture of his love. It was a ransom. A ransom, it meant to buy the freedom of a slave or a prisoner. So the ransomer would put up a huge sum of money that would take the place of the slave or the prisoner so that they could go free. When the Apostle Paul in the New Testament talks about the problem with like human nature, these are the terms he uses. He says, the problem is that we, apart from God, we're enslaved to the desires of our flesh. We want what we want, and all of it is tainted by sin. We can't even see it. And even if we could, we wouldn't be able to free ourselves from it. That's how bad the predicament is. We need to be ransomed, and Jesus paid the ransom. Not with money, but with his life. This is what makes the gospel good news. The gospel is not an announcement about what we need to do or should do for God. It's a declaration of what God has done for us in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus and is now doing for us through his Spirit. If you leave here thinking primarily about how you need to be a better servant, you will have missed the point. If you leave here having known firsthand that Jesus stands among us to serve you, that will change you. That will delight you. It'll fill you up with such power and love that you will then become the kind of person who wants to give your life away for the good of others. You'll have the desire and the resources to do it because Jesus himself will give it to you. Communion brings us back to this every week. Through this meal, we remember how Jesus serves us through his life and death and resurrection, and how he serves us now through his intercession and the power of his Spirit. What I love about this meal, I was thinking about this morning, is that it engages the whole person. It engages our minds. It engages our bodies, like we come up here. It engages our hands. We receive. This is the thing about the kingdom. The thing that you need the most is not something you can take. It's something you have to receive. It engages our tastes. The whole thing just reminds us that we need to be transformed at like the deepest levels of our personhood. It's beautiful. Let's give thanks for this meal.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.